Welcome to this episode of Anaesthesia on Air, the podcast from the Royal College of Anaesthetists. My name is Emma Plunkett and I'm a consultant anaesthetist and a college tutor at University Hospitals in Birmingham. Today I'm joined by Jim Brunning and Joe Pick.
Hi, I'm Jim Brunning. I'm a consultant anaesthetist at the Royal Orthopaedic Hospital. I'm also the wellbeing lead and the college tutor there, and I'm an examiner for the final FRCA.
Hi, I'm Joe Pick. I'm an anaesthetic registrar at Stoke Hospital. I am a wellbeing lead for UHNM, and I'm also newly elected to the Association of Anaesthetists Trainee Committee. However, I'm here in a private capacity.
Lovely. Oh, well, I had a role on the trainee committee as well, so I'm sure you'll enjoy it very much. So today we're going to be discussing wellbeing in the context of sitting exams, although we hope that the content will be useful more generally as well for everyone. And I think anecdotally, everybody knows that examinations are stressful, but there've been a couple of publications over the years that have really kind of identified this as well. So it was mentioned, examination stress was mentioned as one of the emerging themes in the 2017 RCOA report into trainee morale and welfare. And then there was a really excellent publication in 2019, which was the Satisfaction and Wellbeing in Anaesthetic Training Study. And they surveyed anaesthetic trainees in the southwest of the UK and identified, kind of looked for rates of stress, burnout and depression. And they identified that more than 7.5 hours of non-clinical work per week was an independent predictor of adverse psychological outcomes. And I think that sort of highlighted to me that that time in your life when you're doing a lot of non-clinical work is particularly stressful. And then I was at the college tutors meeting last month and we heard a presentation from Professor Tom Gale and Dr. Sophie Winter, who've been leading a study exploring the stresses in anaesthetic training. And they're also identifying mechanisms to improve wellbeing, because after all, that's what it's all about, isn't it? Knowing what stresses us as an anaesthetic community and what we can do about it. And examinations were listed as one of the non-clinical stressors. No surprises, really, along with portfolio, logbook and ARCP. So there are lots of difficulties in anaesthetic training. But I think what's really positive is that we're trying to think about ways to kind of address those difficult times. Jim, I know this podcast came out of a teaching session I think you were doing at the Orthopaedic Hospital.
So I've got quite a strong interest in wellbeing, and I think that the specialist years are particularly stressful because of the sort of ongoing nights and weekends, and then the added pressure of family life and keeping up a social life, and then the exams in general. I personally found them very stressful. We have a final FRCA teaching session and I focused quite heavily on self-care during that, and then was struck by the feedback at how people felt that they weren't necessarily hadn't had their well-being focused on as much previously, and I think that sort of struck a chord with me. So, and as an examiner, I see people very, very stressed as they come in, and certainly all of my colleagues, we really try hard to get people to perform as best they can during the exam. But obviously, some of that is dependent on the preparation prior to the exam. So I think if we can try and help people to optimize their time, both for looking after themselves and then also making their learning efficient and effective, so then they can come in and perform as well as they can do, and then hopefully pass first time, which not everybody does.
Yeah, no, that would be lovely, obviously. We're going to start by reflections, our own reflections on exam experience. I think, Joe, you're probably the closest to the exams. Mine were a few years ago now. So how did you find the exam process?
Well, I probably consider myself an expert on the exam process based on the number of times I got to sit it. I actually had sat the final on 3 occasions. And I probably had a different experience for each different one. And I suppose probably part of my intentions for wanting to come on this is to sort of relay part of my journey as well, and hopefully share why I think I got it better on the last one. So particularly the second sitting, I found particularly difficult. And that's because I think realistically, I had a lot going on at home. It was fairly stressful and difficult time. And I think being realistic with myself, I probably wasn't in a place to actually sit the exam and give it a proper go. And I found it very stressful, very uncomfortable. And actually, I don't think I reassessing sort of where I came from with that, I wouldn't have done it had I, sorry, can I start again on that one? So yeah, I think realistically, were I to look at where I was on my second sitting of the exam, I wouldn't have done it. However, I felt for my third and successful attempt, I felt that I was a lot more prepared. I'd really reappraised where I was. And actually, it was a really pleasant, I'd say verging on pleasant experience, including preparation the night before. And even the exam day itself was a completely different experience. So really, I think the way that you approach the situation and the day itself can make an absolute massive difference to how you perform on the day.
Yeah, that your story makes a lot of sense, really. I think I was really fortunate in some way, the timing of my exams. Actually, they, for whatever reasons, it was pre having a family, so I could focus a bit more easily. Not everybody is in that situation, and that puts additional pressure. And knowing what else is going on in your life and making sure this is the kind of right time for you to do the exam. And when I've kind of supported trainees, sometimes people have sort of come saying, I'm actually not sure this is the right time to sit the exam. And I have quite a few conversations with trainees, I'm sure you do as well, Jim, about kind of thinking about whether this is the right time to sit the exam, and do they have the headspace, you know, the support and everything that allows them, people to kind of focus on the exam. I think thinking back to my primary, it was a long time ago now, but I revised with Matt Cross, and we subsequently wrote our revision book together, and we had a really productive, and you know, had that sort of right dynamic of a team around us to kind of make the revision process a lot smoother, really. So timing definitely is important. You know, we know it's stressful sitting the exams. What is it particularly, do we think? I know it sort of sounds a little bit obvious, but what is it that makes it so stressful, do we think?
From my perspective, I think I've really reflected on this as a concept. And I think there's a significant fear of basically being exposed as a fraud. So obviously you've gone through all this anaesthetic training, you think you can do your job, and then there's a thought of being sat down opposite to what you perceive to be experts in what they're about to ask you, and they're about to find you out. That was a real significant concern for me. Another one I think was probably, we're talking about like time pressures and, you know, advancement of your career. So I think with the way that progression points work within the curriculum, it can be very, very stressful that, you know, you're not going to achieve what you need to achieve when you need to achieve it. You're going to require extensions of training, or even, you know, as a threat of dropping out of training itself was actually a significant concern for me as well.
Yeah, I agree. I think all of those things. I think I didn't find GCSEs and A levels particularly stressful, but I found myself quite anxious around the final in particular, because it does, yeah, impacts on your ability to progress, as you say, and the self-esteem. And I think it's a combination of you've spent a decent amount of time that you would probably have been rather doing other things in your personal life. There's a large, substantial, considerable financial implication for it, for failing. And that all weighs heavily on you. And you feel, I think, the expectation of your family, self-expectation, and also of your colleagues and contemporaries that have gone through seemingly without trouble. I guess the only thing I'd say to that is don't judge other people's outsides by your insides. I think it's easy to look at other people and feel like they've flown through. I don't think that's ever the case. I think there's a certain amount of work that has to be done. Joe, I'm curious, what would you do from your third time that you would try and do in your first time if you're able to sort of wind the clock back and save a bit of money?
Yeah, money, time, grief, lots of things saved. I've actually, you know, I thought about special advance again, and I prepared an FRCA style answer to this. So I've categorized this. So I've gone with home / personal on this topic, study and the exam itself. So, you know, cut me off if I'm running on. But in terms of home / personal, I thought one of the most important things for me was to get everyone at home on the same page. So my wife isn't medical. And I think it took a lot of sort of, effectively for my first attempt, I don't think she quite understood or appreciated the magnitude of the exams. And I think after the second attempt, I sat down We had a conversation, and I explained to her, this is what I need to do, and these are the consequences were I not to pass on this occasion. And I thought that was incredibly useful, because it meant that we could all kind of work together, and she understood that, you know, if I had to of an evening go and do a study group, that it was all for a greater purpose. So that was probably one of the most important things I did. Other things at home, I just did a lot more ring fencing with my studying. So I went, this is study time, and I didn't let it drag in. I said, I'm going to do an hour now, and then I'm going to come and I'm going to play with my daughter or do something like that. And that was probably one of the most important things I did. I also sort of tried to reframe a little bit as well. It's just an exam. It's not the end of the world. They're not going to kill me. At the end of the day, the worst that could happen is I just fail. It's not the end of the world. Other sort of things in regards to studying, I think probably getting over the fear of practicing particularly with senior colleagues. I had done it before, but if I'm going to be honest with myself, I don't think I fully threw myself into it. So I was lucky to be a very supportive department. My educational supervisor was fantastic. We'd have weekly sessions where we'd sit down and he'd just go through the book and we'd just do scenario after scenario. I also typically in my usual fashion decided just throw money at it and go on a course, which was really beneficial. The particular course where it was a high fidelity. So actually the experience of going through the exam was fantastic, and it was very real focus on technique. And then actually specific then to the exam itself, I chilled out beforehand. Whereas before, I remember the night before rapidly, you know, trying to learn the brachial plexus again. And I realized that that's not necessarily going to benefit me. If I haven't learned it then, I'm not going to learn it at all. So the night before, I was staying at my sister's house. I sat down, had dinner, had a beer, chilled out, and went to bed at 9:30. And that was a much more pleasant experience. And then, as I said, on the day, I think due to preparation, I was a lot more used to it and a lot more comfortable. So I was able to sit down with the examiners, and it just felt normal, like we were having a conversation and we were able to exchange ideas rather than necessarily feel like I was being grilled. So those are my big things.
I mean, they're brilliant. I'm like making notes of like what I can do to kind of support my trainees actually as we go along. And I love your categorization, you know, the mark of a true exam pro, I guess, isn't it? So, I mean, and lots of kind of themes generally for life, actually, even the whole sort of ring fencing your time. I think sometimes, you know, if you do have to do a bit of work when you're at home, just really so telling the people that you live with how long you're going to work for and sticking to that. So that's something that I kind of sometimes try and do. And then, you know, knowing that you've got time for your family or friends, whatever, outside of that. And I think you're right. I listened to lots of other wellbeing related podcasts, but one of my favorite ones at the moment is the Happiness Lab by Laurie Santos. And she was talking about wellbeing at work. And I need to find this study, but apparently there was a study where they showed lots of doctors funny videos and then asked them a diagnostic quiz, like a sort of house style, conundrum. And those who had watched the funny videos first were more creative, more innovative. So actually the importance of getting yourself in that good frame of mind where you can kind of think more clearly is really, really key. Jim, what would you add? So you've done loads of work on kind of lifestyle medicine, wellbeing generally. Thinking about how you can prepare in that revision period, what would your advice be?
I'll try and echo some of the points that Joe's made and then dive into them a bit more. Certainly one of the biggest things is practice and technique. You can know all the things in the world, but if you are unable to classify it reasonably and listen to the question, then you may not do as well as you should do. So I think Joe's point about it being a conversation, we genuinely want you to pass. We want to get the best out of you. And that's what we train to do and try to do on a regular basis. I think doing day-to-day work, I think, makes a big difference. If you're at work and you're on a list with someone, just get a book and ask them and get over that. It is uncomfortable, but it's more uncomfortable doing it for the real thing for the first time, and treat each and every time as if it's the exam. Body language, tone of voice, pace of voice, intonation, all of those things, if you practice on a daily basis, then the sequential sort of cumulative benefit of the consistency of that will stand you in really good stead for the exam. With regards to the exam day itself, I think Joe's right, trying to be in a relaxed frame of mind as possible. So breathing techniques and visualization techniques, I would thoroughly recommend. So most people would, certainly for the final, you've been there for the primary, visualize yourself there at the Royal College and visualize yourself in a calm frame of mind and either close your eyes and do some breathing techniques. There are several out there. There's lots out there, either box breathing, 4-8-8 to 4-7-8. So in for four, hold for eight, out for eight, or the physiological sigh, which is a really good one you can do quite easily, where you take in an inhale and then a quick sniff inhale. So double inhale and then a long prolonged sigh. So it goes. And a few of those, it's a natural physiological things to do. Animals do it. And it helps. It's really good to quite quickly get in. There's another eye gaze one if you type in eye gaze Huberman. So you can look sequentially at different distances and then adjust your focus accordingly and then look at your nose at the end, I think, and breathe in a sort of relaxed manner along the way. That can help you just to bring yourself further away from the sympathetic sort of overexcitement and more into a balanced state where you can recall things, as Laurie Santos was saying, I think. Get things out there because it is in your brain and it's just being in the optimal part of that performance curve. You're never going to be relaxed, but you are. It can be an almost pleasant experience, as Joe was saying, and genuinely that is what we want. We want people to be able to demonstrate and showcase their knowledge. I think imagining like it's just you're presenting a patient you've seen on an on-call to the consultant or to a colleague. I've seen this patient X, Y, Z, and these are the problems. We're not trying to catch you out. We really aren't. We don't want lots of AAGBI monitoring, all of these things. We just want you to try and listen to the question and give us a sensible approach to the answer. That's what we're after. I think lifestyle-wise, sleep is vital. Planning some time outdoors makes a big difference. So again, actually, if you do some revision and then go for a walk in nature, your brain tends to process and store memories really well when you're walking. And you also can become quite creative when you're walking. It's a very good method of getting ideas out and formulating things there. I think you mentioned working with people. I agree wholeheartedly. There's something different about speaking knowledge out rather than just writing it down or reading it that perhaps activates different pathways in your brain. And Joe, I think you mentioned sort of working with different groups of people can really help that. I personally found it really helpful working with a colleague and a couple of people. When you're asking and listening, you pick up stuff and you learn from other people in a sort of verbal story-like way. And that probably is easier developmentally as human animals than it is just reading a stark textbook on your own in a dark room, which I don't think does much for anyone's well-being at all. I think time blocking, either through something called the Pomodoro technique or various other methods that are out there. And included in that is time to walk or to exercise, to plan your meals, to try and eat simple things, try and eat as much whole food as possible. I'm conscious that it isn't cheap, but things like using meal kits can actually free up some time for you, or using some meal prep type ideas. So you batch cook things and then you've got some relatively healthy food there to use. I think probably the biggest lever, and I'd be interested in your view on this, is sleep and trying to maximize that as much as possible. That's a vast topic in itself, but learning when you're know yourself, know your chronotype. So if you're an early morning person, then perhaps shift your morning a little bit further forward and get half an hour's good work done in the morning, most mornings, and then you've won the day. And then you can revise that later by talking it through with a colleague later. I think if you use your time at work well, then you will need to do much, much less time at work at home. And then that removes that thing from the 7.5 hours of non-clinical work leading to burnout as much as is possible. Sleep, I mean, caffeine, you can think about light blocking glasses. Setting a bedtime, I think, is a really useful thing to do, and setting a wake time and keeping to those. Lots of people are inadvertently giving themselves social jet lag by getting up at a different time at the weekend, and actually keeping to a set routine is probably more helpful.
I totally agree. I mean, obviously, I've done lots of work around sort of fatigue and sleep, and as I've read more around it, I've changed my sort of practices and really tried to kind of prioritize sleep. I guess the thing to say though is, when you obviously insomnia is so difficult to deal with, and sometimes it's quite easy to get into that. And I have been guilty of this, where I sort of know how important it is, and then I worry about the fact that I'm not getting enough sleep. And so just to put it out there, you know, obviously just be kind to yourselves and try and get into the, it's all about building healthy habits, isn't it, with all of this. And so if most of the time your sleep is good, the odd night where you can't sleep actually becomes much less significant. And, you know, we all work shifts and out of hours, so we're never going to have perfect sleep all of the time. So just sort of prioritize your kind of sleep when you can, really. And I think absolutely it's key about knowing yourself. Like, I am definitely better in the morning. I'm more creative in the morning. I learn better in the morning. I get very, if I have to sort of write anything or learn anything, I'm much better doing it in the morning. But there are some people, I've got colleagues who actually work really well in the evenings. And actually, I think sort of one of the things around this whole revision process is knowing yourself and knowing what kind of works for you, and then thinking about all those ways that you can kind of optimize, make those little tweaks in your life, you know, working, being, it's quite easy for bedtime to slip, isn't it? And you actually, you've lost an hour here, and then suddenly you're on 6 hours sleep a night, and we all know that we need more than that. So actually trying to be a little bit disciplined about it, kind of where you can. And you spoke about so much stuff there. It was great, the whole sort of walking in nature and kind of trying to get outside when you're revising, and that whole idea of telling each other stories and working with people. Like, you know, we love hearing sort of about cases, don't we, and discussing cases, and actually making that a really useful part of our revision. My daughter's just done GCSEs, and she was acting out her Latin revision with a friend. But I think it's like making it interesting, finding ways to make it interesting. And then you talked a little bit about sort of time management and the idea of the kind of meal prep. And actually, I think about really noticing that saves you time, and then using the time it saved you to do something, rather than, you know, thinking, you know, if I'm going to use this meal kit, I don't need to spend so long creating my meal. So then what can I do with that half an hour? And can I just do, you know, a little bit of exam revision, or can I just spend the time with my family and work things that way? Joe, what are your thoughts about, you know, general healthy habits to support well-being, particularly at this difficult time?
Yeah, so I think some of my decisions may become, I've learned these afterwards, because since the exam I've gone on a bit of a journey of self-discovery. But actually, I think the topics of sleep are incredibly vital. And for me, I've really tried to practice a bit of better sleep hygiene of late. So things like caffeine intake, I'm significantly limiting / not really drinking caffeine after midday. Screen time is a big thing for me. I'm chronically addicted to my phone, and I know this, and I will play on it in bed all the time. But I've switched away from that now, with the intention of actually trying to get some decent sleep. So now, instead, I've tried to switch to reading a book, which has been far more pleasant, and I've noticed my sleep has significantly improved. Jim, obviously, we raised the issue of like meal kits and meal planning. And I think probably the concept of decision fatigue is really significant, because when you've got a lot going on, the ability to just remove these day-to-day decisions, which actually take up quite a lot of space in your brain, is really, really useful. And I'm not necessarily saying this is entirely, you know, buy a kit or something like that. But maybe recently, so what I've switched to recently is actually having, fairly boringly, a meal plan for 2 weeks. And that's what we eat every 2 weeks. And it's so much nicer, because you're not sat there at 1 o'clock in the afternoon going, do I need to, what should I defrost? What are we having for tonight? And I found that's been a revelation in terms of giving myself some mental space to actually do what I need to do.
Well, Steve Jobs and Barack Obama do, isn't it? I think they have the same clothes, and so that there is no decision to be made around that. I think I was going to say, on sleep, there's a really good book that's very quick to read that helps with this anxiety around insomnia, which is Sleep by Nick Littlehales, who talks about sleeping in cycles and working your chronotype and things like that. And his point is that we sleep in cycles, but you get most of the restorative sleep in the first two cycles. So actually, I'm not advocating this by any stretch, but if you only get 3 hours sleep, you've probably got the majority of your deep sleep that you're going to get in that night anyway. And there, he gives options in there if people want to go and look at that. Things like going ironing, low maintenance, keep the lights low, low cognitive load tasks, and then allow yourself to go back, reading, allow yourself to go back to bed when you're starting to feel the urge to sleep again. I think that can sort of, that tries to take away the, I'm not sleeping, I'm worried, I'm not sleeping, why aren't I sleeping, that most of us have at one stage or another, and particularly when exams are around. Again, breathing before you go to sleep, breath techniques, 4-8-8, progressive muscle relaxation, which is where you breathe in and then squeeze muscle groups consecutively and then release on the exhale. That can be quite profound for some people, actually, really sort of tense up and screw up and then let go with a sigh. And you can play white noise. There's loads of things on YouTube. It's a balance, as Joe says, whether you should have your phone in the room or not. And I think we're all probably addicted to our phones too much. And I notice if I play childish games on my phone past 8 o'clock, I don't sleep as well. So I've tried to work on that personally. But yeah, I think all of what you said, Joe, is absolutely on the nail.
It does make a lot of sense, doesn't it? There's another book, I can't remember its name, but it talks about light exposure and that our bathrooms are probably the brightest rooms. They all have really bright lights and you don't get dimmer switches in your bathroom. Where do you go to clean your teeth just before you go to bed? You have a really bright light, don't you? So just thinking about kind of your practices around that. I used a lot of Headspace actually, especially in COVID when it was difficult to sleep, just the guided meditations. I think they really help, don't they? And Joe?
Just on the topic of light, out of interest, have either of you invested in blue light glasses? And is there any sort of benefit to them?
I do have a pair. But embarrassingly, my eyesight is not so good anymore, so I can't read so well when I'm wearing them. So I need now some actual reading glasses, which are the blue light ones. But I think a lot of devices now have the settings, don't they? So they sort of dim. But there is science behind them, isn't there? So blue light suppresses your release of melatonin, and it's not just the going to sleep, it's actually the quality of sleep as well. So I do have some that and if I had to do a piece of work, say, late at night, then I might well use, yeah. Yeah.
We've got, my wife uses blue light blocking glasses. I'm very blind, so I can't really. But we use red lights in the bedroom to read by. And I try not to turn the bathroom light on for precisely that reason. And sometimes using candles and things. It's amazing how sleepy you get, actually, if you don't have your lights on and you just light some candles or accept the street lights outside, how quickly you can then drop off. But yeah, I mean, I think the two things are, the two main levers for me, and I'd be interested what you two think, are sleep and then genuinely being as compassionate and kind to yourself as possible. And from there, you can then move on into all of the other areas of progress, in inverted commas, in life. It's not easy, but I think most medics are very hard on themselves. We're all mainly driven people, and it's what those drivers are and whether we can change them to more productive, helpful and kind drivers rather than the sort of self-flagellation that often drives a lot of us.
I think that's absolutely right, and it's about being realistic about what is possible for you. And you know, there's a whole list of things that we know we can do for our well-being, and sometimes you can, oh, well, I'm not doing this and I'm not doing that. Actually prioritize one or two things that actually you think are important for you, and actually notice when you do them well and give yourselves credit for that. And Joe, what are your thoughts?
Well, I'd sort of describe myself as a bit of a well-being tourist. So I think what I do is I sort of look stuff up, get very excited and decide that I'm 100% into cold water immersion for a short period, you know, etc. But I think sort of the thing I've kind of discovered during the past year whilst I've been doing all this is actually, it's not necessarily the individual aspects, I think. Like, it's actually the process and the thought that you're wanting to do something to help yourself that I found most beneficial. So I think the ability to take a step back, look at yourself and go, how am I going to necessarily improve this situation, is probably the most valuable thing I've done.
Yeah, I think that's right. And that's probably what we find quite hard, that whole sort of self-compassion, isn't it? Sort of noticing what we're feeling, not having the judgment, like accepting that it's part of being human and we are human, and then thinking about what do we need to make a difference for ourselves and actually sort of prioritizing that. I wondered, and there were a couple of areas when we were kind of thinking about this that I thought might be a bit, people will have encountered in the kind of run up to exams. So the two things were sort of procrastination, getting started, if you either of you had any tips around that. And then we've talked a little bit about this already, but the other thing is that feeling of overwhelm and, oh, there's so much to learn, I don't know where to start. So I wondered if you had any sort of particular tips around either of those areas that or experiences to share.
I think a habit diary sometimes. So sometimes I'm a world-class procrastinator, unfortunately, and just get on with it, I think, helps. But that's easier said than done. Sometimes you can say, I'm going to do 5 minutes and then we'll see what happens. And just starting then allows you to move into it. The time blocking, I think, is really helpful, because this is your time for it. And then you're going to move on and do something different, hopefully something more enjoyable or a treat of some description. They can work quite well. I think a gratitude practice, whilst it sounds cheesy, is actually really useful. Just taking a few steps, a few deep breaths, and then thinking about what you're actually grateful for in life. I quite like as well the sort of remember you're going to die scenario, and that one day this will all be over, and for all of us, and that will you remember this day, this hour at the end? It's very unlikely that you're going to remember these things. And in the grand scheme of life, whilst that's easy to say, these moments are not too important on a day-to-day basis. Obviously, the exam is a big milestone and you'll remember that for the passing for a long time. But actually trying to put things into perspective through just sitting down and realizing what's important to you, friends, family, pets, all of those things, I think they're the important things in life and the things that we remember when we are towards the end of life. Bronnie Ware, The Regrets of the Dying. I think that's a really useful thing to go back to. So what do people say when they're terminally ill and in hospice care? That, I think, is really impactful, and trying to acknowledge those things that will matter when the time comes, hopefully not for a long, long time for all of us, but it will come. And trying to imagine what you want to be said on your deathbed and said about you when you're no longer here. You can take it either morbidly or in a positive way, and I choose the latter.
Yeah, I think there's that video, isn't there, where it zooms out of the world, of like where you live, and then you realise, and then the kind of pale blue dot thing, it just gives you a bit of perspective. And I think when you're in that moment of overwhelm, actually trying to something to help you get a bit of perspective, I completely see how that's relevant. The other thing around the procrastination was the kind of understanding what motivates you. And some people are very intrinsically motivated. I have a podiologist friend who if he's going to do something, he'll do it. And other people need accountability of doing it with someone else. And actually that's why, you know, if you've got a group of you revising and you know you've got to turn up and prepare something, then sometimes that kind of helps to motivate you kind of work-wise. Joe.
Yeah, so precisely that. That's exactly what I was feeling I needed to say. I am an awful procrastinator, and realistically, the only time I was truly efficient was when I was logging into a Zoom call with my colleagues and had to do some work. I found that that was the best way to get stuff started. And even then, if I fitted something, a little bit of theoretical reading around afterwards, maybe even on some of the topics I'd not covered that my colleagues had answered perfectly, I found that particularly useful. Just on the topic of feeling overwhelmed, I thought for me, there's a couple of aspects of the exam that felt overwhelming. So one, the content, like the sheer mass of content. And I know it sounds stupid, but anyone ever watched the episode where Chandler gets married in Friends and he runs away? And they say sort of, you know, tell him to take it step by step. And it is just that, isn't it? So you can just take it step by step. Oh, you just got to put on your suit. Okay, well, I've just got to start revising, you know, the nerve supply to the larynx. Like that's, it's just that step, and you can only do so much at a time. And then obviously, you know, eventually at some point you've got to get married, but it does, I found that was very, very useful. Just another aspect of the overwhelming I found was kind of the theoretical, you know, career, future, life, etc., and not necessarily realizing what you may have. I think we've got to consider the fact there is also alternate routes within our career that aren't CCT. There is now, after fantastic work from, you know, obviously our SAS colleagues, I think Rob obviously gets a shout out as per, but the CCT isn't the be all and end all. There are other alternative career paths that are completely viable. And I think the moment I realized that, it took a lot of pressure off as well. So I think that's also vitally important to remember. Just because we're on this one path doesn't mean that there aren't other options, effectively.
Yeah, I think that's really key, actually, isn't it? Just to kind of give us a bit of perspective around all of this. Reflecting back on what we've talked about, Joe, your point right at the beginning about how what makes it so stressful about feeling like a sort of potentially feeling like a fraud. And actually, of course, that's not the case. But actually, what we can do to kind of help our colleagues as they're revising to kind of give them practice and give them confidence in their kind of abilities is really key. I wondered if any particular tips, key points to kind of emphasize.
So I thought potentially, you know, we've got to focus on, you know, Maslow's hierarchy of needs. And I think that's kind of where I think I went wrong for my second attempt, insofar as I didn't make sure that everything else was set up and sorted, and I wasn't right and I wasn't ready. And I think realistically, I'd encourage anyone looking at the exam to really just take a focus, prepare yourself. It's going to be difficult. There is going to be challenges. And you've got to make sure that everything else is set and sorted before you undertake it, because otherwise it's really destabilizing and it's a very unpleasant experience. So I really think you need to give yourself that opportunity and give yourself that best shot by making sure that all of those other aspects are sorted.
Jim?
Yeah, I think you saying that has really struck a chord with me about what Joe was saying. One of the things that's really helpful is saying out loud to other colleagues and people those very truths. That it takes courage to do that, and I acknowledge that, and it's not easy to expose your fears to other people. But actually, again, the act of just saying those things that are worrying you often removes a reasonable amount of the weight of it, and then you can just have a laugh, because most people will go, yeah, that's exactly how I felt, and that is exactly how I still feel as well sometimes, because that, I think that's partly a nature of being human and partly a nature of the medical profession, whereby you know how much you don't know, and you know that you can often be wrong. So I think naming the fears and trying to move towards being as kind and compassionate to yourself, being a good friend and ally to yourself as possible, are the main things, really. I think sleep, and as Joe says, sort of a bit of well-being tourism and shopping is in order for everyone. Some things will work for you, some things that won't. And just because someone said meditation is amazing doesn't mean that it's going to work for you. I would suggest, though, that breath work and meditation are vital too. Really vital, actually. There's a phrase, isn't there, that everybody should meditate for 20 minutes a day, and if they haven't got time for that, then they should meditate for 2 hours. Now, I appreciate that isn't realistic, but I think the ability to take that step back and put things into perspective and to respond calmly and coolly is exactly what is going to help you during the exam. But just get going on a day-to-day basis in theatre. Everybody has been through this. Everybody knows it's hard. And most people will want to help you. So take that help, ask for help, and acknowledge that you need help on occasions, and be kind to yourself.
Brilliant. Joe, final thoughts from you.
There's two things that I just wanted to jump in with. My first was a question to everyone else. What's the most recent well-being thing you have tried, and what did it do for you? And the second was, obviously, it'd be remiss of me as Association of Anaesthetists trainee member to not plug some of our well-being facilities. I know I'm on an RCOA podcast, but please check out the association well-being page and our mentoring service, if that's okay.
That's fantastic. I'm just trying to think of my kind of latest well-being related habit. I'm quite a fan of the cold water swimming, and I haven't been as often as I would like, so I do the whole cold shower. It's a bit bonkers, but actually I find it really invigorating. That's a little thing that I do. And then, oh, the other thing I've been doing recently is my middle daughter plays hockey, and I was taking her to a hockey match, and they didn't have enough players, and I thought, why not? I'll have a go. And so actually it's been really fun to kind of get into that. But I subscribe to I read a book called Time to Breathe, actually, which is about burnout, which by someone called Bill Mitchell, which talks about non-negotiable habits. These are low bar things that you do regularly to kind of look after your kind of well-being. So it's not aspirational things, it's just the things you do every week. So I make sure that I do some form of exercise at least once a week, because that's really important. And then I prioritize my sleep. So those are my kind of low bar habits.
So one thing I've done in the last couple of months is have salts in the morning. So I don't have coffee to start with. It's a mixture of sodium, potassium and magnesium. There's loads of them on there. Element is the expensive one. You can get much cheaper ones that have the same composition. And that actually, I think, sets you up quite well for hydration. Caffeine doesn't work first thing in the morning because you're still clearing your adenosine that's built up to promote your sleep. So then I delay my caffeine for a little bit. I gave up caffeine and I found it awful. So I'm afraid I've started again, but I'm reasonably good at sticking to not after midday. And I do notice I had a coffee at 3 or 4 o'clock the other day and my sleep was awful. So they're the main things. The other thing I'll plug is Breathe with Sandy, which is a great breathwork thing on YouTube. There's so many free things out there that are done, and you'll find something that suits you. I think breathwork is vital. It really does reset your sympathetic, parasympathetic system, and you look at the world with fresh eyes and you can laugh at yourself again, which is always good.
That sounds fab. I had so many tips, actually, just from this conversation about things that I can do and things that I can do to help my colleagues as they're going through exams. So I hope everybody listening has found something useful, and that they will share the podcast with those people they know who would also find something useful from this. So thanks ever so much, Jim and Joe, for your time today. It's been a real pleasure to speak to you.
Thanks, Emma.
Thanks.
The RCOA warmly welcomes members from across the globe. So if you are based outside of the UK, we invite you to discover the array of benefits available to you as an RCOA international affiliate. To learn more about joining and to explore the benefits of membership, visit rcoa.ac.uk/international-affiliate or click on the link in the show notes.